I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today it's Bird News with ornithologist Vernon Lox, who joins us from the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket. Good morning, Vern.
Good morning, Mindy. It's a stormy morning over here on Nantucket, and if you hear in the background a bunch of banging and stuff, that's because it's blowing here. I just heard the forecast that Dan gave. It's blowing already 30 miles an hour. I'd say it's gusting to 40 or 45.
Wow. It seemed a little gusty here, too. And of course, fall migration is underway, and whenever we have the gusty winds like we're expecting today, you never know what might blow in.
I like the more unsettled the weather, the better it is for bird watching. I know he says like good news, sunshine tomorrow. I wish it would stay stormy for a while.
No, but then you can't get out there really.
You can actually. Bird watching in bad weather is really exciting and it's good. So I get a little tired of all the sun, but that's just me. I know everybody, most of the listeners would love to have a beautiful sunny day, and that's hopefully what'll happen tomorrow.
But now you've got me curious, because if you're out bird watching in stormy weather, they're not flying around in wind like this, so where are you looking for them?
Well, no, like today with this southeast wind, when I get off at lunchtime, I'm going to run down to the south side of Nantucket off the beach where the wind has been howling in from the southeast. And what's to the southeast of Nantucket? The open ocean, the Atlantic and the Gulf Stream, and a lot of birds, I love it when it's really windy at night, because at night the birds are sitting or flying and they can't see the land, and they sort of just go with whatever the wind direction is, and they get pushed up much closer to shore, pelagic seabirds, than they would like to be. And then what happens is at first light, they get up and they reorient, and often if you go down to your favorite beach on an ocean beach, and you know, if you spent an hour there every morning watching for seabirds, you would be amazed at what flies by. And so I'm just excited. There could be tropical terns. I bet there's three or four species of shearwaters. There could be a rare southern pterodrome. I just have dreams about birds. So
you're all excited about this weather.
Well, any kind of weather, right. I would prefer to have a nice clear night with a northwest wind now, because then the land birds, the warblers and the vireos and the flycatchers and the orioles that nest north and west of here are all starting to head down to the tropics for the winter. And it's really amazing in August, you don't really, most people, I don't think, realize that there's 20 species of warblers passing through here this week and next week. And you really have, you think it's summer, but it's really already the start of the fall migration. And the insectivores are starting to leave and head south.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number for your bird comments, questions, stories this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So now we talk about the migrating birds, but there's also birds who stick around, our year-rounders. So what are they doing now to prepare as the days are getting shorter? They know what's around the corner.
Well, for the year-rounders, we're talking about black-capped chickadees, song sparrows, house finches, the birds that are that are here 12 months a year and are essentially non-migratory. Although that's actually not true either, because some of these birds do leave the northern parts of their ranges. But the birds that are in your yard now, a lot of them are going to be there year-round. And they've finished the breeding season. They should be done. Maybe some robins are just finishing with their last brood and stuff. And now is the time they have to, this is the season where there's lots of food around, where they grow new feathers. They all go into a full molt. So they're going to grow new wing and tail feathers, which is very energy intensive. And then they're going to grow new body feathers. And of course the birds, ducks, geese, and swans are the only birds when they molt that drop all of their flight feathers at the same time, which renders them flightless.
Oh, boy.
And for most birds, that would be a disaster, because they'd get killed by predators. They couldn't find food. Imagine if a red-tailed hawk or a blue jay lost all its flight feathers at once. But for the waterfowl, they can go, after the breeding season, they can go paddle out into the water and stay away from predators. Like when the snow geese up on the Arctic tundra, there's places where there's over 1 million nesting snow geese. They all, at the end of the breeding season, go molt at the same time, and they drop their flight feathers, and it literally looks like a blizzard in the summer with all these white feathers, and they basically overwhelm the predators. The Arctic foxes, the wolves, how many can they eat? Plus, they can get away because they can swim. Anyway, I digressed there. I just started thinking. I'm sorry. I got off on molt.
You're just excited about this weather.
Well, I had some coffee this morning.
Oh, there you go. And Vern, you mentioned the robins. And it's interesting because the robins that we have here in the winter are not the same robins we have here in the summer, correct?
That's correct. The robins that you have in your yard right now or that you see are going to migrate south from here. But there are robins present on Cape Cod and the islands all year. And then the robins that nest in Newfoundland and Labrador, robins are a hardy, widespread species. They actually nest, they go as far north, they actually nest above the tree line in some of the Arctic tundra.
Wow.
Which just, you don't think of robins, at least I don't anyway, of them being that widespread and successful. And they're also prolific breeders. At this latitude, most of them are having three broods. So if they'll start in late March, early April, so a pair of robins could raise as many as 12 robins in a season. So when you start in the spring, there's two. You know, in the fall, there's 14 if they all make it. Yeah. And anyway, the ones that come and spend the winter here, because the Cape and Islands are loaded with all kinds of fruit and berries. We've got red cedars, the juniper tree, they call it the red cedars. Any kind of multiflora rose, a lot of the invasives that have been planted, privets. They eat any kind of, because insects and worms are not available when it's below freezing, but they quite happily subsist on the fruits and berries. And the ones that come from the north, you know, if you were to take some nice, clean photos of the robin in your yard now, and then when you see some robins in the winter and try to get good photographs of them and put them side by side, the birds are quite different. And not the ones that are spending the winter are bigger. They have blacker heads. They have different streaking. They're not a full species, but they really are. You can recognize different races, especially when you see them side by side.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. Joan Rose is giving us a call from Eastham. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to comment or ask questions about catbirds. I have so many in my yard, and are they nosier than other birds? They're always looking in my windows. I had company this weekend. They couldn't get over the fact I was telling about them, and sure enough, there they are looking in the windows. They're always hanging right. If I sit on the stoop with a cup of coffee, they will come right next to me. Are catbirds nosier? They seem very bright.
Well, catbirds are amazing, and they're one of my favorites, too. I love, they'll actually come, if you had raisins or grapes or in your hand, they would come take them out of your hand. And they're amazingly, they're very inquisitive. They seem to be completely unafraid of humans. They're in the family, they're in the Mimidae, they're in a mimic thrush. And the other birds in that family around here are brown thrasher and northern mockingbird. But the gray catbird, of which 98% or 99% migrate south down to Central America for the winter and Mexico, there are a few actually overwinter. Their behavior at this time of year is incredible. If you put jelly out, like any kind of grape jelly, strawberry jelly, in a little dish, watch what happens. And the catbird, they'll follow you around the yard once they know what it is and start eating it.
I mean, if I'm in my garden, they're there. No matter where I am, they seem to follow you around. They seem to know you or something. I just thought maybe they were brighter than other birds or more inquisitive. I find them very interesting anyway.
They love to follow you around in the yard because you are, especially if you're working in the garden, if you're turning anything over, you're exposing worms and insects, and you're, for them, you're like a, it's like a, it's
Here
like
comes
an
the
ox
snack
pecker.
Cart. Yeah.
Right, like they recognize that you're going to flush different bugs and stuff, and you're providing a meal for them, so they're going to follow you. And they're like when they're at the house, if you leave a light on at night, I have some cappers. I try not to leave lights on at night, but if I do, and moths come to the side of the house in the morning at first light, the catbirds will be there picking off all the insects. They'll come up and clean up whatever is stuck on the shingles or on your screen. The catbirds will come eat.
That's funny.
So they do seem, I don't know if they're more intelligent. They say most people agree that the corvids, the crows and jays, are the smartest birds.
I know.
But certainly catbirds, they seem to have it going on.
Certainly curious. Jane Rose, thanks for the call. You know what's funny? A few years back, my daughter used to talk back to this catbird would speak to her. You know, she'd imitate it, and it would follow her around and talk back to her. Who knows what they were saying?
That's it. Yep. Well, they are a pretty good mimic, yeah. Although they're not as nearly as ventriloquial, or they can't do what a mockingbird can do, but catbirds can make a whole variety of noises.
Yeah, they're fun. Jane is calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Are we on?
Yes, we are.
You're on.
I had some static on the line. I wasn't sure. I have a catbird story. We were sitting on our porch, and a catbird, it was a hot day and kind of dusty, and a catbird came down into the sand, and all of a sudden, he was kind of jumping around and, like, trying, it looked like something was biting him. He was turning his head, and then we realized he kind of ran away from the spot he was in and pecked at himself as though he were picking something off himself. Then he ran back to the spot and put his tail, fanned his tail out, put it over the spot, and started pecking at himself again. And it turned out he was going over to an anthill and the ants were going onto his tail. When the ants got on his tail, he ate them from it.
Wow.
So he was repeatedly going back and forth to this little anthill. At first we thought, oh, something must have bit him, you know, like a wasp or something, or a bee. But it turned out he was repeatedly going back to the spot, getting ants on his tail and eating off his tail.
Could you actually see the catbird eating the ants?
Yes.
You could, yeah, because there's a lot of times northern flickers, a fairly good-sized woodpecker, they engage in this what's called anting, and they'll go down to an ant mound like this, and they'll grab an ant in their beak, and then they'll take the ant and they'll rub it all over different places on their feathers, and they'll drop that ant and get another one. Oh. Ants have formic acid that they excrete when they're threatened. All these big ants, and that's a natural. It's a very effective insecticide. And what the flickers are doing are killing the feather mice, the lice and the mites that are on them by using the acid. It's like they're putting top spot on themselves, so to speak. And I don't know that. I mean, I wonder if the catbird was engaging in a little bit of that too. It's getting probably the ants were worried and attacking it and putting some formic acid on its tail, and then he'd eat them. He got a twofer.
Because he was repeatedly going back and doing this.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's very interesting. Yeah. I've never heard that for catbirds.
Yeah. Jane, thanks for sharing that. We appreciate your story. Thanks for calling in. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number for your bird questions, comments, or stories. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with ornithologist Vernon Locks. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Vernon, we're talking about some of the birds that are migrating and then some of that are sticking around and getting new feathers and using lots of energy, whether you're coming or going. So is this a good time to put the bird feeders back up?
Boy, that's a... Well, I think it's a little. I'm feeding out here where I work at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation, and all the gold. I mean, it's amazing. The feeders are emptied twice a day. I'm going through so much seed, it's crazy. And most of these birds, if you want to start feeding, you could now, but I would recommend that you really don't start feeding until mid-September.
Mid-September, okay.
That's what I would wait, because right now there's a lot of places have a rodent problem, and if you put seed out now, the young squirrels and the various there's a lot of rats in a lot of places.
Ooh, we don't want that.
Most people don't enjoy that. I actually have a special setup here where I don't mind the rats because I put the feed out where they're in the open, and at night, I mean during the daytime, I have red-tailed hawks and Cooper's hawks that sit here and actually hunt rats, and at night the barn owls on Nantucket take care of the rats. So I don't have a rat problem. I'm feeding the raptors while I'm feeding the birds and the spill that goes over and blah, blah,
well,
blah.
Well, that works for everybody.
Yeah, it does, but there aren't
everybody
many
except the rats.
Right, there aren't many places that works, and I don't really know anybody that enjoys having rats around. I think I'm rather an exception to that.
I think so. Well, I have left my hummingbird feeders up all summer. Which I usually don't have hummingbird feeders, but I think we had somebody a few months ago said, leave them up in the summer and see what happens. And finally, I have seen one of the hummingbirds actually go to the feeder. They prefer, obviously, I think, prefer the flowers that are in the garden. But I thought, it's just, you know, they're just sitting there and only things eating them are bees.
Well, a hummingbird feeder, you know, hummingbirds are such, it's hard to believe when you see, I just saw one at a feeder yesterday, and you forget how small and how fast they are, and just, they're incredible. And when they do visit a feeder, sometimes they're only there for 2 seconds.
Right.
So even though your feeder's up, unless you're staring at that feeder a lot, you're not going to see most of the hummingbirds visit.
No, but
I think it's great to have feeders up now, and because of people providing hummingbird feeders, we're finding out a whole bunch of things about hummingbirds. You know, it was believed there was only one hummingbird that was ever in the East, the ruby-throated hummingbird, which is the only one that nests in eastern North America. But it turns out now that because of advances in digital photography and stuff, we have learned that, there's a hummingbird called the rufous hummingbird that winters in Mexico and further south and goes as far north, up the West Coast, and breeds in Alaska every year. Imagine a hummingbird flying that far. Well, a lot of these, it turns out, we get rufous hummingbirds here. They're becoming almost annual in the fall migration. In fact, there was a male rufous hummingbird at a bird feeder up on the New Hampshire-Massachusetts line in like mid-July, and then one showed up in Connecticut, another bird are the same. And the female types are much harder to identify, but it turns out that any hummingbird really after about the 15th of September is just as likely to be, it's more likely almost to be a bird from the West. So if you have hummingbird feeders, I would say keep them up.
I'm going to keep them up, especially next month.
Until mid-October or so.
Yeah.
Because you're helping the hummingbirds, it's for them, it's like a flower. It's just a flower that keeps on giving. And if they came in from somewhere, they'll feed for a few days, but they'll keep moving. You're not going to encourage them to try to overwinter or anything. That won't affect them. So you're helping the hummingbirds, you're not hurting the hummingbirds.
And I was really happy when I put up the hummingbird feeders in the beginning. They weren't attracting hummingbirds, but as you know, I got those Baltimore Orioles. So that was worth it.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, sometimes catbirds will come to hummingbird feeders and drink the sugar water. Chickadees will do it as well. Orioles come to it. They're attracted mainly by the bright colors, but once they realize there's sugar, you know, there's water in there, they'll go. And yeah, it's very, they're neat.
I got an email that says, I'm seeing a lot of female hummingbirds at my feeder, but only males rarely. Why do you think that is? Also, are there other birds that like to eat the nectar? You just answered that question.
It's funny, it turns out the males and the females really segregate themselves. They don't like to hang out together. It's weird, the males, if a male is coming to a feeder, plus hummingbirds are very feisty, very territorial, and the only time the males and the females like each other is for a few minutes during the breeding season. That's basically, so if you have, generally if you have a female or a young one, because it's really almost impossible to tell them apart, you're going to get more of the same, you're going to have more females. If you have a male coming, you're probably not going to get anything else because he's going to run off other males and stuff. He's going to set that up as that's his feeder, that's his territory. But generally, the males migrate south sooner, it seems like, as well. So
yeah.
Anyway, keep the feeder up and enjoy them.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You know, I have a couple butterfly bushes, but you know the one I'm talking about that seems to attract all the butterflies and hummingbirds and, you know, in my yard.
That's the good butterfly bush.
That's the good butterfly.
As opposed to the bad.
No, they're both good, but that's the one we really see. And my husband was walking by and he said, come here, look at this. What is that thing? It was another one of those little sphinx moths.
It was a hummingbird clearwing moth, or hummingbird clearwing sphinx moth.
Yeah.
It was an amazing insect that just usually freaks people right out. They have no idea what they're seeing. They're most moths are nocturnal, they're slow flying. This thing is a it really imitates, it looks like a cross between a bumblebee and a hummingbird.
Exactly.
And it's a really fast-flying diurnal, a daytime moth that feeds on nectar. And there's actually two species on the Cape, and they're fairly common. And they go to all sorts of nectar-producing plants. They're great.
Yeah, no, they're fun to watch.
You know, the butterfly bushes, it is funny. Some of them, they have all these different varieties. But whenever I go, of course, I wish they were native, but they're not. But boy, do they keep flowering all summer if you deadhead them. And they really do attract, they produce so much nectar. They're the best thing to attract butterflies that almost you can get. But whenever I go by them, I go to a nursery, say, and they'll have 30, 40 varieties. Just walk around one and see which one has butterflies on it.
Oh, good idea.
And if it has those are the only ones I buy.
Do the deer eat them on Nantucket?
No, they don't eat them here, even on Nantucket. Whereas they eat stuff here they don't eat anywhere else.
That's right. Yeah.
I've never had them eat a butterfly bush yet.
All right. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Tony is giving us a call in Chatham. Hi, Tony.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Good.
If you don't mind, I'd like to get back to the catbirds eating the ants.
Yep.
But I have two beehives in my yard, and uh-huh. I have a catbird that continually takes bees from the front of the beehive. And actually, it started with one catbird last year, and now it seems like I've got five or six of them that seem to be just making a living in front of the beehives. Have you ever heard of this before?
I've heard of a lot of birds. So you're raising honeybees?
Yes.
Yeah, so you're obviously this is not, you're not delighted that the catbirds are picking off your bees because the bees have enough problems.
Right.
I have not, you know, I've, of course, over in Asia and Africa, there are birds called bee eaters that specialize. They have long beaks. Here, the only bird that routinely, eats bees are different tanagers in the spring, summer tanagers, especially when they, and scarlet tanagers will eat them. But I actually have never heard of catbirds eating bees. I know of several beekeepers on the island here that have
the hive, or he or she, and waits, and then he'll just drop right down on the ground in front of the hive and then fly right up, grab one right off the entrance, and then fly away with it.
Hmm.
Wow. And so does this happen all day long or just early or late in the day?
Usually I see it in the afternoons. I'm really only there to observe it on Saturdays and Sundays. But I had like one or two catbirds that I saw around the yard. Now it seems like everywhere I go in the yard, there seems to be catbirds.
Mm.
Yeah, it looks like they've taught the other ones or their young ones, like, come over here. This is a good fast one.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they don't. I didn't realize they could handle what they do. Have you ever watched one eat the bee? How do they do it?
They just, all I see is he just grabs it from the entrance and then flies away, right? I have a wood pile next to the beehive, and he flies in behind the wood pile.
Hmm.
Wow.
And there's a sort of a privet hedge behind the wood pile. He goes in there.
Go ahead.
I'd be curious if, you know, we've got a lot of people who raise bees around, if there's any beekeepers that have a similar problem. I'd love to hear what, you know, how they've resolved that issue.
This would seem to be a big problem, because if the catbirds learn to eat the bees, there's a lot of catbirds, and they could really, I feel bad for him because he's losing, you know, a lot of honey and a lot of bees. So.
Yeah, Tony.
Yeah. I'd never heard of that before.
You know, unless I get a huge flock, if it would really highly impact the hive, but it's still, it's after the work you put into it and after what the bees are going through, it's already kind of...
All right, Tony, we're putting the word out there. If any other beekeepers...
Tony, I'm going to do some research on that, and if I find anything out, I'll get it to Mindy, and she can put it up on what, on the website?
Yeah, we can put it up on the website, and we can talk about it next month when you're on. Yeah, great.
Okay,
thanks,
Tony.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Jim is calling from Barnstable. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Mindy. Hi, Brent.
Hi.
Long-time listener, first-time caller. Love the show. I had questions about turkeys.
Okay.
Up until about... Well, I've been on the Cape for 25 years, and until recently, about 5 years ago, I've seen this great influx of turkeys. And in my backyard each night while I'm eating dinner with my family, I see them fly up into the top of the trees and perch or roost for the night. But then I won't see them for another week. Do you know anything about the behavior of these? Are they actual birds or raptors?
Oh, no, they're a gallinaceous bird. They're related to chickens and ruffed grouse and bobwhite, but they're, you know, turkeys are sort of their own. Turkeys are rather unique. They eat all kinds of stuff, and sadly, the turkeys on the Cape and the islands are basically were transported here from they're quote unquote wild turkeys, but they're really not afraid of people. I don't even know if they, you know, the Cape is so popular. I don't know if they're hunted at all on the Cape. And they actually have become a problem in many places because they're like a roving gang of turkeys that just come and rip up people's yards. They'll sit on their cars. I remember there was one in Centerville that was chasing the mailman down the street, or kept attacking the mailman. So they're sort of birds that got moved here, released, and now they've totally not afraid of humans, or they're not. And they're quote unquote wild, but they go to a lot of bird feeders, and they tame right down. So they're almost like a semi domesticated turkey, and they're huge birds. And the reason, they can fly, but not very far, and not for very long. But and they've learned to go up into the trees at night, so that coyotes and foxes and raccoons, there's a lot of things that would like to eat them. During the daytime, though, they're so tough, really. I've seen a couple of turkeys being attacked by a coyote, and they fought the coyote off. They were kicking and stuff. Yeah, it was amazing. So I just
they seem quite intelligent and highly protective of their brood.
Oh yeah, they're pretty fierce in defense of their young. I think you're lucky that they move on and only show up once a week. You wouldn't want them there every day.
Yeah, especially if you have children in the yard, they'll chase the kids.
Yeah, they will.
Yeah,
it seems to be nighttime entertainment for our dinner to watch them go up.
Yeah,
good. Are you feeding birds?
No.
Okay,
no.
So they're not eating. You're not providing any food for them.
No, they tend to forage around the yard. I don't know what they're looking for. Little bugs, probably.
They eat almost anything. Any kind of insect, worm, fruit, berry. They eat a lot of vegetable stuff too. I mean, they'll eat. They're omnivorous and eat. They have a huge appetite.
All right.
So you mentioned that they weren't native. How long have they been on the Cape then, do you know?
Well, no, they were native to all of eastern North America and further. And, of course, they were basically hunted out, the wild ones, in the late 1800s when a lot of everything was cut down. And then they were sort of reestablished by the fish and game, the State Department, for people to hunt. And they actually got the birds out in, I think it was Pittsfield, Mass., and brought them and released them. But since then, you're driving along Route 6 or, you know, wherever you see them, they're really not, you can walk right up to them. They're not really what I would consider wild birds at all.
Scared.
In fact, why would you hunt them? You wouldn't even need, you know, you could hunt them with a baseball bat. It would be crazy.
Yeah. Jim, thanks for the phone call. Yeah. We got full lines here, so we got to move on. Thanks, Jim. Martin is calling from East Falmouth. Hi, Martin.
Hello. I just have a few questions, one about a hummingbird and one about an osprey.
All right.
Okay.
A few weeks ago, there was a probably ruby-throated female, and she was flying about an Atlantic white cedar tree like she was interested in the needles. What is she getting off of the tree this time of year?
I would imagine she was probably catching some sort of really tiny insect, like an aphids or something that was feeding or something. I bet there was a tiny insect. I just saw some video somebody sent me with a giant lens and a super slow motion, and it showed hummingbirds fly catching, eating the smallest bugs, these incredible, you wouldn't be able to see them with the naked eye, I don't think. And they had slow motion to show how, because we think of them as just feeding on nectar, when in reality they eat probably 70% of their food is insects. And they'll eat stuff so small that we can't even see it. So I would guess, a couple weeks ago, it wasn't nest building or anything. It was catching some sort of bug that had hatched there.
Well, that's good. And it also was visiting some red flowers we had in the backyard, so it's good.
Right. There it was getting nectar, yeah.
Maybe nectar was the dessert. But what's the osprey question, Martin?
Well, we've had some people interested in this question about osprey young. Once they've fledged, there have been some problems with construction and stuff, people removing nests for construction projects. But I've heard it's legal to remove the nest right after the chicks have fledged and moved on. But how vital is that nest to them, even after they've learned to fly?
Well, I've never heard of anybody doing what. Where is this? Somewhere on the Cape? This is very unusual. I've never heard of anyone taking down an osprey pole.
It's happened in Barnstable with construction sites and on boats and things where ospreys are nesting where they're bothering people. But
I can understand it on a boat. You know, that's going to be problematic. But it, you know, if there's an established, somebody put that pole up. I don't know if there's any laws. I mean, ospreys are not endangered, but I can't even imagine doing that. I never heard of it before. So the young ospreys will come back, you know, but the big problem is the adults that raise the young there, that's their nest. And even though they're not there anymore, they're flying around getting ready to head to South America for the winter. They'll be back in March and their nest pole will be gone and they'll be forced to find another location, which will cause problems, because then, anyway.
They'll be delayed.
I would think anyone that would do that is pretty much beyond the pale, as far as I'm concerned. You would, maybe if you take it down, you put up another one. You replace it somewhere, you know, just a little further out. You can't be. That seems, I never heard of that, and I'm sorry to hear it.
Yeah, Martin, thanks for the phone call. Susan is calling from Westport. Hi, Susan.
Yes, good morning, Mindy. Love the show, learn so much. I have two quick questions, really. We haven't seen bluebirds that we used to see in the 20s, like 20 every season, and then three would stay and nest and come back, but not in the last 2 to 3 years. I'm wondering if they've changed, or is it the fact that the birds drive them out of their bird nesting houses and they don't want to be there anymore?
Where do you live? What town?
Westport.
Westport, Mass.
Oh, Westport, Mass. Okay. Yeah, well, something's changed. In the winter, if you used to have a flock of 20, I would say they should return, but maybe something happened to the berry supply. Maybe a grove of red cedars or something got cut down. There's not as much food would explain why they wouldn't be there in the winter. And nesting is always a dicey proposition for bluebirds, because there's a lot of competition for the nest holes or the boxes from tree swallows and house sparrows and other birds. So one way you might be able to fix that is to put up a few more boxes, and if you do have house sparrows in any of your boxes, to remove them. House sparrows are not native to North America. They're from Europe and Asia. They were brought over to this country in the 1880s, there was actually an acclimation. It was a society that wanted to sort of duplicate what was in Europe, and they brought them over. As well as they brought them over into Central Park in 1886 in New York to authenticate Shakespeare's plays. Any bird mentioned in any Shakespeare play was brought over. Of course, imagine 1886. You don't jump on a jet. They were on a sailboat, and they had like 6 or 8 pairs of each of these birds in cages, and they brought them across the ocean. They let them go in Central Park in the spring, and of the, I think it was 98 species of birds, only 2 survived. House sparrows and European starlings, and both of them spread like wildfire. They spread from coast to coast. They spread to the edge of tree line and down. It was basically like releasing these winged rats that had no competition. Not only did they do really well in cities, but they do well out in the country and the farm. Both are cavity nesters, and they really wiped out a lot of our bird populations. Plummeted, especially bluebirds and tree swallows and things from competition. Nowadays, it's still...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
She had a second question, too.
Okay.
Is the aperture make a big difference if it's really maintained and not enlarged by other birds? Or does that really keep the bird...
The entrance hole on a bluebird box is an inch and a half, and an inch and a half hole is good. There's different designs. The other question,
because I know you have lots of callers. Do owls duet? Do they sing in duo? Do they call each other and then sing together?
Great horned owls and barred owls will duet together. Screech owls do not. Saw-whet owls do not. Some of the larger owls, both the male and the female will call. And because the female is bigger than the male, about a third larger, she's got a bigger, booming, basser voice. So you can actually tell when you hear, you can tell which one's the male and the female.
Right.
And they often duet, yes.
All right, Susan, thanks for the phone call. Julie, hold on. We're going to talk to you after a quick break. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeendislands.org. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with ornithologist Vernon Locks. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Julie is calling from Falmouth. Julie, thanks for hanging on. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a similar experience with a fellow beekeeper about bird-stealing bees.
Really?
And she had a terrific solution. She lives in North Falmouth, and she put up a string, kind of like a light clothesline, in front of her two hives and strung shiny ribbon, and hasn't had any more problems with bees approaching, with birds approaching and stealing her bees.
Oh.
Do you know what kind of birds were stealing the bees or eating the bees?
I'm afraid I do not, but I doubt very much that they were catbirds. She had put up a couple of bird houses. And I'm not a birder. I'm a beekeeper, so I don't really know my bees, but they were very tiny brown birds.
Wow. Well, you're forgiven for not being a birder. it's okay. I'm glad you're a beekeeper.
She withheld the bees from the birds, but she was alarmed because they were taking the bees in some numbers.
Yeah.
And as you know, we want to keep those numbers up.
Right. That's a clever solution.
Solved her problem immediately.
Yeah.
So for the other caller, there's something you can do in the meantime.
And it sounds like it's a pretty environmentally friendly type of way of.
Yes, that's a very benign solution.
Exactly.
Without killing anything. That's
right. Good. Julie, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate your
You're
phone call.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
You too. John is calling from Barnstable. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning, Vern. Good morning, Mindy. Just wanted to give you all from the Whale Watcher and put in a word for the seabirds. They are out there. It's been some great pelagic birding recently.
What have you been seeing, John?
Well, we've had all four of our common shearwaters, the quarries, the sooty, the great, and the manx in just great numbers around where we've had feeding whales in particular. The terns are on the move, and we're starting to see some jaegers coming in the area, some parasitic jaegers. It's just a great show out there for birders and a great time. But the other thing that was on our mind this week is we've run into three different seabirds, an immature northern gannet, and two of our sooty shearwaters with entanglements in fishing gear and a laughing gull with looks like a sandwich bag over his head.
Oh.
And, for boaters, for fishermen, it's just real important to keep our gear out of the water. A lot of these seabirds live long lives, and to see it ended by a piece of fishing line is a real tragedy.
Yeah,
it's a great point. Fishermen need to be really, if you're going to dispose of gear or anything, just make sure you keep it in the boat and dispose of it properly, because fishing line lasts forever, and I find 50, 60 birds a year that are dead from things like that. So that's right. A great point.
And the plastic bags, that's another good point. Keep the plastic, throw it away.
I tell you, I head offshore whenever I can on a friend's boat, and the amount, the balloons that you see offshore are just unbelievable. There's floating, it's made me want to really have like a ban on balloons because people don't realize all those balloons end up out in the ocean and sea turtles eat them. They think they're jellyfish, and it kills them. Seabirds eat them. It's just causing all this damage. It might be fun for a birthday party, but they're going to blow away. And anyway, I'm really down on balloons right now.
John, thank you.
Always remind our whale watchers, we say, even if you live inland, there's one thing you can do, is don't let balloons go at your celebration.
Right.
Get rid of them responsibly.
Yeah.
It's horrifying how many you see when you go out. Yeah. Out to the edge, I'll be 120 miles offshore, and there's balloons all over the water. It's like, wow.
John, thanks for the update, John. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'd just like to say a little bit about...
Bye-bye.
Yep. Great. Yeah, thanks for that call. And the seabirds right now is a fantastic time for seabirds. And John's actually running a boat out. They go out into Cape Cod Bay off of Stellwagen Bank. And there's a project this year, some people from the federal government working on doing research on Stellwagen Bank have been catching great shearwaters, the greater shearwater, the great shearwater, and putting satellite transmitters on them. I believe they've got transmitters on 11 birds now. And if you go, I don't know, Google Stellwagen Bank or something, or shearwater research, you can actually look at the actual tracks of where these shearwaters are going. I mean, one of the shearwaters that they got on Stellwagen already went up off the coast of Newfoundland, is now across off the coast of France.
Hmm.
These shearwaters do loops around the Atlantic Ocean. It's amazing. They're here. For them, it's winter. They nest on islands south of the equator, the Tristan da Cunha group primarily. And then they come up here. So this is their winter. They're spending our summer. They nest in the austral summer. Anyway, there's some fascinating research going on in the great shearwaters. And if you're a birder or interested at all in seabirds, really, this is a great time to get out. This year, they're having an exceptional year because of the bait that's out there. Lots of whales and just tremendous numbers of seabirds. And as the fall progresses, right, the next few weeks are really the best time. So
yeah, good to know.
Give that a plug, you know.
All right. Allison is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Allison.
Hello. Are you there?
Yes, we're here.
Yep, we're here.
I want to just ask a couple questions about hummingbird feeders. How best to make the sugar water for feeders? The first question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to let Mindy answer that. I know people make it.
Yeah, I just take some kind of warmish water. I have a cup of water, maybe a quarter cup, a little more of sugar, and I just kind of mix it up and then pour it into the feeders.
Oh, yeah, most people I know, it's one part sugar, four parts water. I know a lot of people that actually they cook it, which I don't know. I don't think you have to either. But
okay, well, there was a rule that I remember hearing a few years ago, but most people don't talk about that. So I thought I'd ask. And then the other question is, how soon or often should we change the water and wash the feeder?
Mm-hmm.
So that
that's another. I don't know that I'm. I know someone who does it every 2 days, which I think is excessive.
I do it about once a week. It depends on the weather. I mean, if it's kind of cool out, I might go a little longer. But if it's hot, you know, and if the water gets a little cloudy, you want to put in some.
Right. If you see mold or if it gets cloudy or something's growing, then you certainly don't want the hummingbirds to be eating something that might hurt them. So.
And we don't want the red dye.
Red dye is horrible.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Don't put the red dye.
You attract them. I mean, most of the hummingbird feeders have lots of red plastic on them.
Yeah, I have red glass on mine. The feeders themselves are red glass. So, yeah, we don't want the red dye. All right, thanks, Allison, for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address, thepoint@capeendislands.org. Got an email from Lisa. She says, great show. I have a hummingbird feeder on my back deck. I can see it from my kitchen table. Every morning, I watch the hummingbirds on the feeder. In a window box next to it, I planted an upright fuchsia, which has a long elongated salmon orange flowers. The hummingbirds go back and forth from the feeder to the fuchsia. What a nice morning show that sounds like.
Yeah, that's a very sweet setup. Good move.
Yeah. And then Jess in South Yarmouth sends us an email. Hi, I was wondering why there seem to be so few seagulls anywhere on the Cape this summer. It's especially noticeable at the beaches north and south. Hoping there's not a sinister plot. Thanks, Jess and South Yarmouth. You know, Jess should come down here because I'm seeing lots of seagulls. I don't know.
I'm seeing gulls by just the zillions around here, and of course, all the young gulls are flying, and there's young herring gulls. Pretty much, they're funny. They sound like a kitten mewing. They're begging for food all the time, and the young ones are they're actually larger than the adult birds because. They're fatter and they don't have the muscle tone yet. And their first plumages, when they're hatched this year, their first set of feathers, their feathers are actually bigger and more rounded, providing more lift than the adults.
Hmm.
And then as they get older and they get more, their feathers get a little more streamlined. So they look bigger and they are bigger.
And as far as you know,
I don't know of any sinister plot. And everywhere I go, there's been a lot of gulls, but I'm not on a lot of the Cape beaches that often, especially the popular ones.
And you haven't heard of anything in that South Yarmouth area of a lack of gulls?
No, that's the first thing. I just think maybe if you go down to Chatham, you'll see plenty of gulls.
All right. Let's see. Mike is writing, 2 years ago in late October, I had a hummingbird at my hummingbird feeder. During a cold nor'easter, it would feed, then sit in a clematis on a trellis nearby, then go back to the feeder. That went on for 2 hours. I always keep the feeder up till November and put it back up late March. Several years ago, during a snowstorm in March, I was looking out my kitchen window and a hummingbird flew and looked in. No feeder.
That was from Mike?
That was from Mike.
Mike, yeah, well, boy, Mike, should anything like that happen again, you see a hummingbird in late October, I would call someone, or I hope you have a digital camera with a big lens on it. Get a bunch of pictures, because that was almost certainly not a ruby-throated hummingbird, and it was a bird that we don't, you know, it could have been anything from the West, and it might have been a new bird from Massachusetts, but yeah. Without really good photos of the spread tail, the length of the wing, the bill, it's impossible in hindsight, but that's very cool that you had a hummingbird at that time of year.
Yeah. You know, you were talking about some of the birds you see at the shore and offshore, but I just want to read you from the Mass Audubon. You know, they have the bird sightings last week. Here's the birds that were in Nauset Marsh. A royal tern, a black-headed gull, 9 black scouters, 2 American oyster catchers, 425 semi-palmated plovers, 130 red knots, 2 white-rumped sandpipers, 700 semi-palmated sandpipers, 210 short-billed dowitchers, a lesser black-backed gull, 40 roseate terns, 3,000 common terns, 4 Arctic terns, and a Forster's turn. A lot going on.
Oh, yeah. That's, I was going to say, you should, I have a blog up. I do a bird walks twice a week out here, and I write up each one that tell, anyway, yeah. Those numbers are not bad. I could do better. But the, what was the first bird you mentioned there on that list?
Royal tern.
Right. Well, that's the rarest bird there. And royal terns, of course, are very common from South Jersey down around the Gulf Coast. They're a big, big oceanic tern with an orange bill. And generally, they're quite scarce north of the islands. That's a nice bird. When Hurricane Arthur whistled through here, it drove a bunch of southern terns up into Nova Scotia and stuff, and they've been heading back south. So anyway, yeah, no, Nauset Marsh is a fabulous place for birds, and that's a lot. But, you know, Chatham has even more birds.
Yeah.
So it's a great time to get out. There's all kinds of stuff. And the shorebirds are basically, the adults have already peaked in their migration. The first young sandpipers are just starting to come from the Arctic. And the birding literally just continues to get better right through Labor Day now.
Yeah.
And then the best birding on the Cape and Islands is really in September and October.
Right. That's when you really get excited.
That's right. I'm getting all geared up for the Nantucket Birding Festival, which is in October after Columbus. It's like October 16 to 19. And every year we've run it, we've found some extraordinary birds and new birds for Nantucket and even for Eastern North America. So
yeah,
I'll just have to wait.
Now we have about a minute left, Fern. And I was wondering, remember we talked a lot about the snowy owls. Did any stay through or did they all take off?
Snowy owls stayed very late. Some were seen in late May. And then I know there were actually a couple, none spent the summer here, but I mean, I think there was one in June up in Duxbury, and I know a couple were in Maine all summer. So with that, we had such an incredible incursion last winter. What'll be very interesting is birds that survive, and the snowy owls had plenty of food here because they were getting ducks at night off the surface of the water. It'll be interesting to see if some of these young birds come back next winter. And because they had such a good winter last year, will they come back or will they stay north?
So yeah, that's the question.
We'll find out in November.
All right. Ornithologist Vernon Lux joined us from the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket. Thanks so much, Vern.
Thank you. See you soon.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.